And welcome back on the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this Wednesday morning. We continue on with our Wildcat Wednesday, our discussion with K-State Extension Districts, Keith Martin and Jacob Weber. As welcome back. And Jacob, we were talking a little bit about this walnut caterpillar before we went to break. Now, we didn't really get into, you know, what it looks like, how to identify it, and what trees it's really going to affect. So,
okay. The walnut caterpillar, mainly like its name, it's going to be found on walnut trees, but also pecan as well. It doesn't bother too many other species. It's more or less confined to those just a few species, unlike fall webworm, which can be found on quite a number of tree species. Early on, the walnut caterpillar, when it first hatches out and first couple of instars, it's going to be kind of a brick red color with white stripes along its side going from the head to the tail. About two or three white stripes, I don't remember which. But after it gets to be a third, fourth, fifth instar, what I mean by instar is molts, mm-hmm. When it gets almost fully mature, it's black in color with lots of white fuzzy hair on its body, and it's really easily identified at that stage. Large black caterpillars. And, of course, when they're moving out of the tree and crawling all over the place, they've been in the tree. They're done feeding. They're not going to eat anymore. And they're just looking for a place to pupate. My neighbor had a walnut tree this number of years ago. And I maybe had talked about this before. And the caterpillars were done feeding. And they were migrating down out of the tree and over into our yard. And we must have had about 500 to 1,000 of them crawling around on our back porch and on the side of the house. And I tried sweeping them up a little bit, but they were kind of hard to sweep up. And I got the brilliant idea. Got a nice, powerful shop vac.
Oh, nice.
So I'm going to go out and suck those buggers up.
Nice. Got rid of them real quick, I bet.
It kind of worked. Until I started noticing a kind of really bad odor. And then I realized I made a big mistake because those soft-bodied caterpillars going through that vacuum hose, at about 250 miles per hour and hitting the baffle plate inside the canister and they getting splattered all over the place. I had a gooey mess.
Nice nice cleanup after that.
Yeah, I stopped that real quick. I just let him go. Didn't bother.
Let him go after that. That's interesting, though, that you can kind of, you know, identify which stage and, you know, how long they're probably going to be sticking around that in particular tree just based on the color of them.
Yeah. How long is their life cycle generally?
From egg hatch to maturity, I'm going to make a guess, probably about 3 or 4 weeks, something like that. And then they're mature as a caterpillar, and then they pupate, and then the second generation comes along. The second generation is an overwintering generation. They'll emerge as a moth in the spring and then lay eggs. Of course, the moth doesn't consume any foliage. It just lives for a short period of time. Its sole purpose is for reproduction, for mating and egg laying.
So they overwinter in buildings then, or underneath?
In a protected location. Okay. It can be in the ground underneath plant debris, a wood pile, buildings, wherever they can find shelter and overwinter. They'll overwinter as a pupa and then continue the development the following spring. So.
Yeah, well, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know that they would change drastically in color that way, because I certainly have seen the black caterpillars around, and you're right, they are incredibly noticeable, but certainly just affecting of the foliage of the tree, and you can tell that life cycle as well just based on the color. I think that's pretty neat with it. So.
Caterpillars generally are not too attractive, but there are some that are, and some of them are quite brilliantly colored. Some of them have spines on their sides and on their back, like the Io moth caterpillar. When you see a caterpillar crawling around and it has spines, you leave it alone, because those spines are there for protection, and they can sting your skin, cause allergic reactions. Some of them are quite painful. You want to stay. Give them plenty of room. You don't see those too often. They're not a colony type caterpillar. They're solitary.
They're the unsocial ones of the caterpillars.
All right.
Yeah.
And Keith, anything that you wanted to add on?
Yeah, I might mention on the just follow up just real briefly on the ammoniation of hay. If you are interested in doing that, it's probably going to cost you $25 to $30 a ton to do that. Mm-hmm. But with the current hay prices, you know that it can turn low quality roughages into medium quality, maybe a little bit better than medium quality in terms of grass hay. You only want to ammoniate those roughages which are low quality because if there's too many soluble sugars in the plant, that can cause a problem with toxicity later on. So we're talking about things like wheat straw. We're talking about things like fescue hay after a seed crop's been taken off or very mature. So we're talking about ammoniating low quality roughages. And with that, for example, I took some forage samples of some that had been ammoniated. It went from around 7% crude protein to up around 12% crude protein. You know, the digestibility also increased. So if you are interested, we have, in case it has an excellent video online, I can send you a link to that. We also have some printed information about ammoniation, and I've had a little bit of experience with ammoniation. So if you're interested in doing that, I'd be glad to visit with you about the pros and cons of that. And you can contact me by contacting the Altamont office. It's probably the easiest way to get with me at 784-5337.
Okay, and those rises in protein levels, this would, obviously with the funds are there, this would be something that you would recommend?
Yeah, because generally ammoniation is only talked about when we're in a situation where we have shortages of hay. Then we're looking at ways that we can bale corn stalks, where we can utilize wheat straw, things of that nature. And in quote-unquote a normal year, usually that's not something we talk about, just because if hay's in good supply, well, then the demand is not that much and the price is not that high. But the hay prices are probably at least 50%, maybe in some instances double what they were last year. So that makes ammoniation a little bit more of an attractive option or a viable option, because in years when we have lots of hay, spending an additional $25 a ton to get something from low quality to average quality, when you can buy something for not a whole lot more than that, it's probably not viable. But in this situation, it probably is.
Mm-hmm. And in obvious cases, you know, this is just me curious here, that increase from low to mid value, does that increase the price when,
it makes it more valuable as a feed resource, just because it requires less supplementation if you're going to feed. So yes, it just basically what you're doing is spending money to make something more viable as a feed resource for it, because it ups the protein and also because it breaks down the hemicellulose and partially breaks down the cellulose. It makes it more digestible, which means that if cattle can eat more of it, well, then they can get more energy from it, because they can just simply eat more of it.
Yeah, and just having that quality there is best case scenario in terms of feeding.
Right, it turns something that's pretty hard to use to something that's more usable, I guess is the easiest way to say it.
Yeah.
Well, one other thing I might mention is I always have to talk about Cerisa lespediza when I'm here, but since we did get the rainfall, now that means the Cerisa lespediza is growing and actively growing, so that means if you do have some spot spraying you'd like to do, now that we have growth going on, go ahead and get out there and get after it if you have the time to do that. Because when we're in a drought situation, if the plant's not growing, you can't get the herbicide from the leaves to the roots, just because there's simply not much going on in the plant. Now that we have good growing conditions, we have a lot better weed control. If you've got some problem weeds you're dealing with, that would even apply to Johnson grass. I've had some lots of questions about grazing and haying Johnson grass. If you want to get rid of Johnson grass, contact your county weed director for Johnson grass, and also Cerisa Lespediza, and they can help you with purchasing herbicides at a reduced rate, since both of those are noxious weeds. But since we do have good growing conditions now, we can maybe have a lot better opportunity to kill those than when we have a drought when really nothing's going on.
Yep. And, you know, better growing conditions and things like that. Obviously, we're now in the first day of August. You know, it's still summer months and things like that, but obviously better growing conditions, time of the year. It's also time to start maybe thinking about fall gardening as
fall,
well.
Fall gardening is an opportunity to get a little bit more production out of the garden. Now, we have to think about this in a little different terms, because not every crop that we're going to plant is suitable for fall gardening. I kind of think of fall gardening similar to what wheat growers do when the harvest is off. They plant some beans, after harvest beans, and just get a little more production out of that field. The same is true of the garden itself. We have some crops that maybe have matured and can be removed from the garden, open up some space, and so we can plant some crops that will mature here in the fall, and usually sometimes we'll actually get a better quality crop in the fall as well. Crops that tend to produce leafy parts that we consume, like lettuce, or maybe a swollen root like a turnip, possibly beets would be suitable for fall garden. Carrots, if there's a long enough season, may not be really large carrots, but you're going to have a fall crop of small carrots. It may be something that you may consider. Crops that have a tendency to be able to withstand the light frost would be suitable for fall gardening. Crops that produce fruits, like tomatoes, there just isn't enough time anymore for those to start from a small plant and get into production. But they may get, if it's an early maturing type tomato and planted early enough in the summer, it probably could potentially produce a small crop in the fall that would mature gradually into the late into the season. It's been my experience that crops that such as tomatoes that mature later in the season don't quite have as much flavor as and sweetness as the summer produced crops. So we may think about not planting. Put those out. Sweet corn, of course, cannot accumulate enough energy to produce a crop planted this late in the season, so we want to omit that. Another crop that is grown in the early season, planted very early in the season, peas, is not suitable for fall gardening because the crop does not germinate in high temperatures and would be a complete failure. It just wouldn't work. So there's only certain types of crops that would work quite well. Broccoli probably would work okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe some cabbage or kale would be another crop that would be considered. So fall gardening, something to think about.
Yeah, and real quick here as we finish up, you had mentioned, you know, the ability to maybe withstand a little frost. Are tomatoes able to withstand a little frost or no?
Not really.
Yeah,
they're very frost sensitive. Yeah. A little bit of freezing temperature and the leaves turn black. May not damage the fruit, but it certainly get the leaves, the plants done then.
Yeah, so a little sketchy with tomatoes and sweet corn, definitely a no-go for fall time
garden. This late in the season, it's a no.
Certainly. All righty. That's Keith Martin and Jacob Weber, with the K-State Extension District. Thanks for spending your Wednesday morning with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, Sam.
Yeah, not a problem. We will check in with a couple of more members, whether it's you two or any of the different members of the Wildcat Extension District next Wednesday, a part of Wildcat Wednesday. We'll set it off to Fox News. This is the Mighty 690 KGGF.